From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week's view focuses on several interesting papers that came out just recently having to do with cardiovascular surgery. As you know, randomized trials in cardiovascular surgery for years and years seem to lag behind interventional cardiology and heart failure cardiology, for example. But in recent years, we've seen an upsurgence in the use of trials to really understand more specifically the benefits of certain types of therapy in cardiovascular surgery. And this has been a welcome advance in our field. So I'm going to start with the first article, which was published in the New England Journal. And it is a 5-year trial comparing on-pump and off-pump coronary bypass surgery. As you'll recall, in the last 15 years, there's been a real furor for the notion of off-pump bypass surgery, with the idea that by avoiding the cardiopulmonary bypass, we potentially reduce effects both on the heart, the brain, etc. And this study was published by Schroyer et al. In the New England Journal. It studied over 2,000 patients at 18 medical centers who were randomized between February 2002 and June 2007 to undergo either on-pump or off-pump CABG. And the patients had one-year assessments beginning after that and completed by May of 2008. There were two primary 5-year outcomes. One was death from any cause, and the second was a composite of major adverse events, which included death, repeat revascularization, either CABG or PCI, or non-fatal MI. When they looked at the results, 5-year outcomes, the rate of death at 5 years was 15.2% in the off-pump group versus 11.9% in the on-pump. This was not statistically significant, but if anything, the trend was favoring the on-pump group. The rate of major cardiovascular events at 5 years was 31% in the off-pump versus 27% in the on-pump group. Again, a borderline trend, the p-value of 0.046, comparing the two, favoring actually the on-pump group. For secondary outcomes that were looked at, there were no significant differences. So the authors concluded that off-pump CABG led to, if anything, lower rates of 5-year survival and event-free survival than on-pump CABG. I think this is a very important paper for several reasons. First, it's a large trial. Second, it's randomized. Third, there was this terrific enthusiasm, including billboard advertisements and so forth, for off-pump bypass a number of years ago. This paper, I think, for good, really puts that type of technique into perspective. Clearly, there are certain patients, rare patients, where off-pump CABG is preferred. And that would particularly perhaps be the patient who has an extensively calcified or what we call a porcelain aorta, where any aortic manipulation, including cross-clamping, etc., has the disadvantages of potentially leading to embolization and stroke. But for the majority of our patients, I think this article, along with several others that have been recently published, puts to rest the notion that off-pump CABG is superior to on-pump. It's just not true. I'm going to shift gears now. We're going to talk about the strategy of transcatheter mitral valve replacement. As you know, TAVR, transcatheter aortic valve replacement, has really become a mainstay in our treatment of patients with aortic valve disease. The mitral valve is a more complex structure, and it has a lot, obviously, to do with the fact that physiologically the connection between the left ventricle and the mitral valve is very complex, and dealing with that with catheter-based techniques is an engineering challenge. But we are seeing the emergence of transcatheter mitral valve replacement for certain patients. And this study was a look at the use of transcatheter mitral valve replacements for patients who had a failed mitral valve bioprosthesis. It was published by Yoon et al. And Jack just very recently. So the investigators looked at both transcatheter mitral valve replacement in failed mitral bioprosthetic valves, or valve-in-valve, as well as in patients who had a failed annuloplasty ring, or valve-in-ring, transcatheter mitral valve replacement. The study was involving the transcatheter mitral valve registry, which is an international multi-center observational study enrolling all patients that are having mitral degenerated bioprosthesis and annuloplasty rings undergoing TMVR. And they looked at cumulative rates of death and complications. The results show that of about 250 patients, roughly 176 had valve-in-valve therapy and 72 had valve-in-ring. The patients who had valve-in-ring transcatheter mitral valve replacements had a lower EF on average, 45% versus 55%. And the overall technical and device success rates were acceptable, 92% success for valve-in-valve and 85% for valve-in-ring. But valve-in-ring had a lower technical success rate overall, 83% versus 96%. And there was higher need for a second valve implantation, 1 in 9 patients with the valve in ring group, and overall a lower device success of 76% in valve in ring versus 89% in valve in valve. The mean mitral gradients after the procedures were similar, around 6 millimeters of mercury. But the valve in ring group also had a higher rate of post-procedure mitral regurgitation of at least moderate or worse, nearly 20%. And they had more bleeding with the 8.3% versus 2.3%. Valve and ring patients also had higher rates of kidney insufficiency and lower overall success rate, 58% versus 80%. Also, the one-year mortality was higher in the valve and ring group compared to the valve in valve at 28.7% mortality versus 12.6%. And trying to treat a failed annuloplasty ring was an independent associate of all-cause mortality in this study. So I think the registry study is somewhat sobering for us. I think for sure the transcatheter approach to the mitral valve is coming. We're making progress. Engineering advances are happening. But these failed annuloplasty rings represent a particular challenge with less success, technically much higher complication rate, and a much higher need for a second valve. So we clearly have a long ways to go with that particular group. So finally, I'm going to finish with another study looking at cardiac surgery. And this is a trial published in JAMA just the other day. And it's called The Effect of Levisomendan on Low Cardiac Output Syndrome in Patients with Low Ejection Fraction Undergoing Coronary Bypass Graft Surgery. It's called the LICORN Randomized Trial. This was a well-done trial, and of course the notion here is that if we give an inotrope like levisomendan in a patient having CABG who already has a relatively low EF, maybe we can prevent some of those low-output syndromes that are so devastating postoperatively. They lead to mortality, they also lead to prolonged ICU stay, prolonged inotrope support, prolonged ventilatory support. So the notion of giving a prophylactic inotrope makes some sense. So 13 cardiac surgery centers randomized in a double-blind trial, this group of patients, about 350, 1-to-1 to either levisomendan, 0.1 microgram per kilogram per minute, or placebo. They were followed both in the hospital and out to 6 months. The composite endpoint was low cardiac output syndrome with need for prolonged inotrope infusion, that's more than 48 hours, need for an LVAD, or failure to wean from an LVAD or support at 96 hours after study drug initiation. Also need for renal replacement at any time. So of the 336 patients, the average age was 68, 16% were women. The primary endpoint occurred in 52% of the patients in the levisomendan group and 61% of the patients in placebo. This was a mild reduction, but not nearly significant. Among the three components of the primary endpoint, the need for prolonged catechol infusion beyond 48 hours was the most frequent one seen with 180 patients, but it was not affected by levisomendan administration at all. There was also no interaction with ejection fraction less than 30%, preoperative use of beta blockers, intra-aortic balloon pump, catecholamine in a pre-specified subgroup analysis. Patients who had atrial fib or hypotension, they didn't seem to differ. So the authors concluded that levisomendan compared to placebo did not lead to a significant decrease in the composite endpoint in this particular study. And if we take this together with a recently reported study, LEVO-CTS, which was also looking at levosimendan, I think this trial really kind of puts to rest the notion that prophylactic inotropes given during surgery is going to prevent postoperative low output states. We need to focus in a different direction, since it's pretty clear that this particular strategy is not going to have a dramatic effect. So taken together, I thought all three studies represent interesting recent data on cardiovascular surgery. The bypass paper certainly helping us understand that on-pump bypass looks every bit as good as off-pump bypass for endpoints that we really care about. The challenge with transcatheter mitral valve replacement, especially in patients with a failed ring. And then this last one really validating a previous trial showing that giving an inotrope like levosimendan does not prevent post-op low output syndrome after coronary bypass surgery. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. And all of this information can be found on the American College of Cardiology's website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening. Have a good day.